call it again, North American Properties et al. Versus McCarran International Airport, number 61997. Mr. Ray, you ready to proceed?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to request 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
May it please the Court. My name is Paul Ray, and I represent North American Properties and the general partners who are the appellants in this case. Gerard Dondero is my co-counsel at the table. If this Court does not reverse the two district court orders before it, the county will have taken the airspace in this case without paying just compensation. There are two main issues that underlie this appeal, and the first one is standing, and the second one is value in use, both of which are very important.
Mr. Ray, should we be concerned that there was a failure on the part of your clients to provide adequate information to the court in terms of their ownership, time of ownership, things of that nature?
There was no failure of the clients to provide information.
Limited ownership period?
Yes, as the ownership period. The only relevant date for the taking the only relevant date of ownership is the date of taking. I do have a timeline here that may assist perhaps.
I'm very well aware of the timeline of what occurred in terms of them coming in, selling it to another subgroup, the bankruptcy, and so on, and then coming back after the fact and not divulging that the property was no longer in their hands. But that doesn't obviate the taking claim. I understand that. But so tell us why the court was wrong.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And North American Properties has standing basically because of this court's decision in Argier, and that holds that, as we mentioned, that the party at the time of the taking that holds the real estate maintains the claim to just compensation. Here the district court erred by...
Can I get you to clarify something, Ray? Mr. Ray, I'm confused by the argument here. Are you objecting to the determination by the district court that your client committed discovery violations and was subject to sanctions as a result?
Yes, Your Honor.
In what way did the district court abuse its discretion in concluding that your clients failed to meet discovery requirements?
Yes, in more than one way, Your Honor. But to go straight to what I think might be the heart of your question, is, first of all, in applying the adverse inference improperly here.
I'm not at that stage yet.
Oh, okay.
That is the sanction that the judge decided to impose. Did the judge abuse his discretion in finding that your client's conduct violated the rules of civil procedure and was sanctionable?
Yes, Your Honor.
In what respect?
Well, in respect of the error of law that the judge relied upon, that he made, the court made, as to who had the claim at the time of the taking.
I'm not there yet.
Oh, sorry.
Your clients did not produce discovery, and the judge said that violates the discovery rules, and that behavior is sanctionable. What about that determination I've just described was an abuse of discretion?
Well, it was based on an error of law and errors of fact. And the error of law was the misapplication of the cases of Argier primarily, also the Halfon and the First Western cases, which make clear that the clause in the trust deed is only a secured interest, which is assigned. And so North American Properties absolutely has standing. Maybe this can help elucidate what I mean by that. In the District Court's August 7th, 2012 order, it required, this was the order compelling the production that I believe Your Honor may be referring to, and it required the parties to produce discovery from a non-party that received a transfer of real estate that did not have the claim to the just compensation. And that was, and specifically the order said that it was if the parties believed those documents were relevant. And And previously, in a discovery conference before Commissioner Bigger, the counsel had said there were no discovery problems. This first came up in the August 7th order.
What about the withholding of all the bankruptcy documents?
Your Honor, there was no intentional withholding.
Were they produced when they asked to produce all relevant papers? Because there was a bankruptcy that may or may not come into play based on a statement that was made to the bankruptcy.
Well, if Your Honor will observe with me that at that time, standing was already determined to be summary judgment, so it wasn't relevant.
I'm not worried about standing. They were ordered to produce documents and records. Obviously, they did not do that. So tell me why they did not do that and why the court should say, in response to Justice Hardesty, it's...
Actually, they did produce the documents to their counsel, and this whole problem...
So counsel withheld the documents?
To the extent anyone withheld them, possibly. However, it's my understanding that there was not a withholding of documents, that the, as I was saying, the August 7th order says that the production is whatever is necessary to show, the parties believe is necessary to show that they had standing, whatever they thought was relevant. And it's true that North American Properties did not believe the documents were relevant. And the only way the court was able to reach its decision was through application of an adverse inference. As the court observed, it said that it had no basis to grant summary judgment in both the August 7th order and in the September 21st order. It said there's no basis for summary judgment. I'm just going to do it on the basis of an adverse inference. And this court has held in Bass Davis that an adverse inference is not sufficient to uphold the summary judgment ruling. What would be sufficient is if there was bad faith or willful destruction of documents, but there's no finding of that. And any finding of that would have been an error. The factual basis of the ruling, which also there was a legal error in that, was the judicial estoppel. Again, we're talking about the documents that are being discussed are documents pertaining to a party that received title to real estate after the taking. The transfer of real estate after the taking has nothing to do with who has the claim to the just compensation.
Sure would impact your expert's damage model. It sure would impact your expert's damage model.
I apologize, I don't understand how you mean that, Your Honor.
Your expert testified as to the damage model that they could participate in the McCarran International savings for multiple years going forward, including periods they wouldn't even own the property. You don't think that impacts their damage model?
As to the ownership of the title, I thought is maybe what you meant. But I understand
your expert's testimony and damage model to be that the damages that should be awarded in this case is a participation in the savings that McCarran expected to achieve from these realignments, which would be multiple dollars going way into the future. That's what I understood the expert's report to be. Isn't that what the report was?
It's based on the
life of that participation be a tad bit shorter if you sell the property?
Actually, Your Honor, under the RGF case, it wouldn't be, because you would still have the claim to just compensation. Because once you transfer the real estate, whoever has the real estate no longer has the property that was taken, in this case, airspace. And so the later owners of the real estate without the airspace don't hold the takings claim. So whatever the takings claim is worth, it's worth. It's either worth a lot, a little, or a middle bit, but those are factual issues.
And you don't think that who the person is that got the property and whether they got the airspace or didn't get the airspace is relevant to all of this?
Your Honor, if they don't have the takings claim, yes, it wouldn't be relevant. What's relevant is who has the takings claim.
But shouldn't the court make that determination instead of your client? Shouldn't the court and the other side have access to the discoverable documents to participate in this process in an adversarial way? Isn't that how this system works?
And isn't that the basis of the abuse of discretion, the abuse of discovery that was that finding being made by the district court?
Well, in a sense, if I understand what Your Honor is saying, however, it isn't actually how it happened because the court only applied an adverse inference for summary judgment, but it had no other evidence to support the summary judgment other than the adverse inference, which this court has said can't be done. It's not proper under Bass-Davis.
I'm not going to beat a dead horse. I think we're before that sanction, but please proceed.
And I do understand if there were an irrebuttable presumption that that could be the case, if you had an irrebuttable presumption, but that would require a finding of bad faith or of willful destruction of documents, which we don't have here. And it didn't happen here. And again, if there is, I mean, I see that this could be argued, these things that you're pointing out, but on the other hand, the other side of that argument is that if the documents are irrelevant, then are they actually leading to the discovery of admissible evidence? That's something I'm asking the court to do, is find that Argier does still apply and that whoever has the taking is the one that has the right to the just compensation. The court can observe that the county did not give notice to the lender here to say, we're taking your property, we want to make sure the right party gets paid here. And that's why I say if the only party stepping forward with the right to be paid, we're asking the court to find that they have standing. And I know my time is short, but I did need to say that the basis of the error of the value of the use issue is that the district court erred because it found that public use necessarily foreclosed a profit-making purpose or a governmental proprietary purpose. And that's incorrect because all takings have to be for a public use. You can't have a taking without a public use. And so if the district court's interpretation were valid, you would have the Nevada Constitution and NRS 37009 sub 6 just be surplusage and mean nothing. The county doesn't dispute about this point, and NAP should be entitled to reversal on this point of itself. Also, the county argues that ordinance, the plain language of 1599 must control, but that's not accurate. We know that in the Lucas case, the Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court held that a taking with the purpose of abating a public nuisance does not create an obligation to pay just compensation. And we know from the thorough reasoning of the Sisolak opinion that in this case it wasn't a nuisance, which is all that's stated in the introduction to Ordinance 1599. It was a per se regulatory taking because of the compelled acquiescence of the landowners to the permanent physical invasion of their property. And we also know that the Kelo case said that the purpose of the taking is an issue of fact. And the reason for that is that a court or a government can have a false pretext for the reasons for its taking if it weren't an issue of fact. And Kelo specifically required that the factual determination be made. We know also that the Ordinance 1599 was enacted primarily for a profit-making purpose and for a governmental proprietary purpose. Under Griggs, we know that the airspace is just as necessary for the expansion as the expansion of the runway itself. And 1599 was enacted for the expansion of the runway, as can be seen from the aircraft departure critical area map that was adopted and also the staff report. So safety was not a reason to expand the runway. We know that the county can take property primarily for a profit-making purpose and for a governmental proprietary purpose, as the Constitution and the statute anticipate can be done. And specifically in this case, we know that surplus revenue is synonymous with profit, and we know that Randall Walker, who was the airport director, testified that McCarran makes the surplus revenue and passes it on to the airlines. We also know that nonprofit entities under NRS 81.755 can make a profit. They're just restricted in what they do with their profits. So we also know that McCarran's financial statements say that McCarran is a proprietary fund. It's run like a business and not from taxpayers' money. Here we know that McCarran took surplus revenue, undertook a project to obtain surplus revenue to distribute to the airlines. I would like to reserve a few moments for rebuttal, if I may. And if there are any other questions the court has, I would like to address about
Mr. Ray,
the
should the district court have been concerned about one of the statements in the bankruptcy proceeding that NAP and NAP Inc. erroneously represented to the bankruptcy court that NAP Inc. had no contingent or unliquidated claims whatsoever?
Actually, there's nothing wrong with that statement. It's completely accurate. And again, it's because...
What is this?
Oh, thank you. I understand your question. Thanks. I need to clarify that. So this is that the NAP Inc. did not have the right to just compensation because all that was transferred was the real estate. And it would have had to specifically transfer... I'm sorry. Northern NAP would have had to transfer the takings claim for the takings claim and the right to just compensation go to NAP Inc. So whatever NAP Inc. said it had because it only got real estate is irrelevant to that issue.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Would it be possible that I might have a brief rebuttal?
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Ms. Peterson, you'll have 17 if you need them.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Tammy Peterson on behalf of Clark County, the owner-operator of McCarran International Airport. I'm here with me in the courtroom today is my co-counsel, Mr. Kirk Linhart, as well as the director of the Department of Aviation, Rosemary Facilitas. We are asking the court to find that the district court did not abuse his discretion in finding that North American Properties failed to produce the documents that the district court found were relevant to this inquiry. And I want to kind of back up and put this in the proper perspective. North American Properties actually acquired this property well back in 1978. But in 1988, they executed an assignment of all of their rights to collect eminent domain damages. And in 1996, which was after the Ordinance 1599, was passed. In 1996, that property was then foreclosed on, and they had no ownership or any other rights connected with the property at that time. Now, this information was revealed in discovery to the county after it had already been said that the county had no reason to oppose that North American Properties had standing. But in discovery, these documents were produced, and the county filed its motion for summary judgment on the principles that this court had announced in Argier, that typically the right to compensation for takings remains with the vendor, but exceptions can exist when that right is assigned or when there's a provision in the deed. And in this case, we did have an assignment that was contained within a deed that North American Properties had executed well before the taking. So the county filed its motion for summary judgment on that point. And North American Properties responded and filed an opposition and had no evidence refuting those points, did not produce any further evidence that would refute those points. Instead, as the district court found, they essentially made some uncorroborated argument. And that was the argument about the margin of security that my colleague had mentioned. Frankly, the district court at that time, at the time of the hearing at August 1st, had before him enough to grant summary judgment in favor of the county. But he gave them another chance, the proverbial second chance, and issued his supplemental order asking to address two items of concern that he had. And number one was this argument that they had raised about the margin of security. And number two, he'd asked them to explain or provide further information about this bankruptcy that had occurred. And the county had limited information, but it was before the district court at the time that at some point North American Properties had made a transfer to this entity, NAP Inc., of the property. And then NAP Inc. declared bankruptcy and declared that it had no claims or anything else arising out of this property. And ultimately, in the bankruptcy, there was an agreed order entered into by North American Properties, NAP Inc., and the bank that allowed the foreclosure to go forward. And so the district court wanted further information on this. I think it was trying to salvage some claim that they might have. What ended up happening after five hearings later, he found out that there had been documents that had never been produced in discovery that he found were relevant, and he found that there was an overtly false representation made by North American Properties as to their standing and ownership of the property. And so he did, at that time, say that the failure to produce those documents should result in an adverse inference. But he could have granted that summary judgment motion back on August 1st, and instead he gave them additional time. The case is before you today on another important issue with regards to valuation of takings. And
before you go there, there's a dispute not as to the sanctionability, but whether or not adverse inference should be used in the summary judgment. What do you have to say about that?
Well, there's a couple of things I'd like to say to respond to that. Number one, under this court's standards in Rule 56, the district court could have granted the summary judgment at the time that it was fully briefed and the hearing was held, because there had been no evidence produced by North American Properties to refute the county's evidence that said that they had assigned the right to condemnation proceeds and that they had no right to collect for the taking that occurred from the passage of the ordinance. But then on top of that, then there were these discovery sanctions, which the court has the inherent authority to, in terms of things that occur before the court, has the inherent authority to fashion a sanction that would fit the violation. And he had asked for those documents to still be produced, and they were not produced to the county. And he found, even at one of the last hearings, that there were maybe 22 boxes that had been never given to counsel, and that he found were relevant to the issue of the real party and interest and to judicial estoppel in terms of what was told to the bankruptcy court. So all of these things in connection or why the district court's order should be affirmed. Now, as I was saying, the county is also before you on this other issue, and there were several amicus parties who filed briefs on behalf or in support of the county. I did see other amicus parties here in the courtroom today. I saw Mr. Gary Goodhart, who's here on behalf of the Reno Tahoe Airport Authority and some of the jurisdictions, the municipal jurisdictions, who had filed amicus briefs in support of the county's position. And the issue here is the interplay between the statute on valuation and the Constitution. And the issue came up with regards to an expert that prepared a valuation report on behalf of North American Properties, a guy by the name of Mr. Stan Smith. And he based his opinion on a 1994 staff report that had been presented to the county that had as an attachment a draft capacity enhancement plan that suggested that if runways were extended, that airlines, not even McCarran, but that airlines might enjoy a cost savings over time. And he concluded that the landowner was entitled to a share of these cost savings of these private party airlines, and he extrapolated that number over 70 years. Now, this method of valuation for property is not recognized anywhere. And the county filed a motion to exclude his report and testimony and asked that the district court also look to the interplay between this statute and the Constitution to determine if Ordinance 1599 was even for a profit-making purpose. And the statute, and I just want to talk about the differences, but the statute says that if the property is condemned primarily for a profit-making purpose, then you value the property to whatever that use is going to be, if it's going to be higher. And the Constitution says if private property is taken for any proprietary governmental purpose. So the statute is primarily for a profit-making purpose, and the Constitution says that if it's taken for any proprietary governmental purpose. And the district court engaged in a very thoughtful analysis of what Ordinance 1599, what the purpose and intent of this ordinance was when it was enacted. And he looked to this court's previous decision in Sisolak that had discussed the safety reasons for the ordinance, and he looked to the actual language of the ordinance itself. And there's actually a section in the ordinance that's aptly entitled Purpose and Intent, and it says that the purpose and intent of that statute was to prohibit hazards to air traffic, to reduce or eliminate air hazards, and to reduce air hazards. There was nothing in there about profit. It was only about safety. And so the district court concluded that the purpose and intent, that this purpose for condemning the property that was taken by Ordinance 1599 was not for a profit-making purpose. I would like to address a couple things that my colleague had said. He said that he mentioned Mr. Randall Walker, who was the prior director of the Department of Aviation with Clark County. Mr. Walker had presented an affidavit that was before the court at the time that the district court looked at this argument. And Mr. Walker said in his affidavit that the county is actually prohibited from engaging or making a profit with its airports. The enterprise fund that is set up that is permitted by the legislature, enterprise funds such as the airport or the University Medical Center, had no mention that says that it is for a profit. It says it's in a manner similar to the operations of private business. And the key to an enterprise fund is that you can charge users and that can be used for the operations of the fund. But the characteristic, all of this aside, the characteristic of the entity that is doing the condemning has nothing to do with the statute or the Constitution and how you determine value. Because the statute and the Constitution say you look to the use of what the entity is going to do with the property. You don't look at what kind of an entity is doing the condemning. It's the use to what the entity is going to be doing. And in this case, looking at that with the clear language of Ordinance 1599, it was solely for safety, and it has no mention of profit. I'm happy to answer any questions that the panel may have.
Any questions, Justices? No, thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Ray?
Thank you, Your Honors. I just wanted to address the multiple hearings which were held, and the court is probably familiar with the due process problem that we addressed in the briefs, which was unfair. And this was through the course of these hearings that were referred to. And specifically, as I mentioned, there was this August 7th order that said there's no basis for summary judgment, and also asked for the parties to present whatever documents were relevant to show standing. At that point, there was a summary judgment in favor of the landowners that they had standing, and very little reason to question that. Again, under Argier, it is the correct ruling that they do have standing. But what happened was that so North American didn't regard the documents as relevant, and after the ex parte hearing, for the first time, the court developed a theory that it said had come up in the ex parte hearing, and that was the judicial estoppel argument that the court relied upon. And North American requested to be at that hearing and was not allowed to. The district court allowed the county to brief the issue and decided the case based on judicial estoppel, but didn't allow North American the 30 days that was promised to retain counsel or to brief the issue in a meaningful way at a meaningful time. So the prejudicial effect of the ex parte hearing is exactly what Gunther says is a denial of due process. And I just want to also mention, as to the court's other question that was raised and Ms. Peterson addressed, is the method of profit or of damage calculation. It's an issue, the main point here is an issue of fact, not as exactly how will economists do their capitalization arguments and methodology, but is it an issue of fact, and should the pretext be allowed, or should this court follow all the other precedent that says that the purpose of a taking is an issue of fact?
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Ray, Ms. Peterson. The case will stand submitted. We appreciate your arguments here today.